everybody, and welcome to Tapped Into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me today is my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. And today's guest is the author of Triumph Over Trauma, Randall Hansen, PhD. How are you doing, Randall?
Great. I'm doing very well today. How are you doing, Adam?
Fantastic. And I'm actually really looking forward to talking to you. And so first off, I would love to sort of just get into your book a little bit. And so I know we've had a conversation before and I've read your book. And I think it's really important. And I hope I'm not miscategorizing this, but it's almost like psychedelics 101, psychedelics for dummies kind of thing, where if, you know, you're fairly naive to psychedelics, you're curious, you want to learn more about it, this is a perfect book to do so. And I really appreciate sort of how you wrote it. Like, it's really well done in the sense that, you know, the first third or so is fundamentally about psychedelics, the different types of psychedelic compounds. And then you get into sort of stories of individuals and not necessarily yourself, but of other people and their sort of healing journey. So do you want to just give a little insight to your book and sort of, you know, how it was done and what inspired you to do it?
Sure. Well, first of all, you are exactly correct. When I was talking to publishers, like, what's your audience? And I said the psychedelically curious, because that's just what you said. It's the people that, you know, have heard about psychedelics, maybe from a Rolling Stone article, or maybe they watched the Netflix series or they've heard about the Netflix series or the book from Michael Pollan. And so, but they just don't know a lot about psychedelics. So that's the exact purpose. The hat that I wear proudly is educator. And so the book is written in a way that I hope is both simple and complex, in the sense of that it's easy to read, easy to understand, easy to digest, and cuts through all the, if we want to say it nicely, the misinformation we've been given about these medicines for the last 50 plus years. And then the stories, yeah, I'll tell you where the inspiration came from, but the stories, because storytelling is so universal, and it's just the way cultures from beginning of time have expressed, this is what we do, this is how our society norms, and we pass it down to the next generation. And the other thing about stories is you can't argue with stories. I mean, you can say, you know, it's my story, it happened to me, so this is my truth. You can say, well, I don't know if I believe it or not, but it's still their truth. I never planned to write a book about psychedelics. I think there are some pretty decent books out there. I happen to love How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. I love Psychedelics for Everyone by Matt Zeman. And there are some other ones out there. There's a brand new one from, just lost his name. It would come back to me. It's basically an autobiography of his healing journey, which is also fantastic. But I was on an LSD journey. It's a late afternoon, late summer. I was on my deck, overlooks a lake and a forest, and it was golden hour, and I was just sort of ending this journey. It was a beautiful experience. And then all of a sudden it was just, with psychedelics, it's so hard to describe, but it was just this force. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't this message from above, you know, Rand, you need to write this book. But it was just like, I just jumped up, ran inside, grabbed a pad of paper. I ran back outside because I felt like I needed to be in that exact same spot. And I wrote down this outline, and 90% of the final book's outline is on that original pad of paper. The only thing I didn't have from that outline was the section on microdosing. It was all about, this is how you should get people to learn about psychedelics. And then the more research, the more talking I did with people, the more I realized that microdosing is become such a, there's such a swell with microdosing right now, that had to be included in the book. So I sort of apologized to the LSD and said, no, I have to add this to the book to make it complete.
Well, and it's unique too, you know, the idea that when people talk about psychedelics, or you get to the point where you're speaking on behalf of psychedelics or the psychedelic community, you've had these experiences, chances are you've worked your way up to these significant experiences that kind of only people in the community can really relate to. And it's kind of daunting to people externally who are hearing about these profound experience and ego deaths and all these different things that are kind of scary, externally speaking. And I'm really happy that you went on about microdosing, because I think it's one of those things that it serves a very, very real and functional purpose. It's very effective and it's safe, and it's something that people can just try to experience psychedelics and sort of loosens themselves up a little bit. Because I think one of the biggest issues with people doing a macro or larger dose is that fear that's surrounded with it, the apprehension, the unknown, and that inability to let go. And so, you know, I would really like to pick your brain about microdosing as we progress through this conversation, but I just kind of want to go back to something about your book as well. And I think this is a really relevant thing, that all the proceeds from your book go to three separate organizations. And do you want to tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, and that was sort of also a message in this LSD journey. I mean, you know, I know people are going to be like, oh, this sounds a little crazy. But it was... you know, let me just talk about ego death for a second, because this is something that I'm still integrating and experiencing. But ego death is kind of the wrong word. And even that, you know, we were talking earlier about words, and even that's kind of a misnomer, because people are afraid, like, oh, well, I don't want to lose my ego. And we also talk about ego disillusion, and that's maybe a slightly better word, but kind of, even that. So in my psychedelic experiences, what happens is your ego does sort of get, you know, put down, but it comes back. And in fact, some people's ego actually expands from psychedelics, because the ego is like, man, I am so powerful. But for most people, it's a reduction in ego.
It's a humbling experience.
Me, it's so bad that, someone posted, a picture of me, a headshot of me, and the whole headshot took up my entire screen, and I freaked out. It's like, oh God, no, you know, it's too much. You know, little Ran is okay, but massive Ran is not. And that's what I mean. That's what I think about ego death. It's not, I don't have an ego anymore, but it's like, ooh, I don't need to see my face and every post I do. I don't need to do selfies anymore and things like that. So it changes that, your mentality. So with this journey, the LSD, you know, is like, you're not, you know, my story is not in there, partly because LSD is like, it's not about you. This book is about the storytellers. And that's totally true. That's why there are 23 stories in there, because that's the focus. And then the other thing it said was, you know, and you're not going to profit from any of this. Let's make this all about healing. And so I talk about the book having, you know, first by buying the book, you're going to learn about ways to heal yourself. And then by buying the book, you're actually also helping others heal that you won't even know about, because the proceeds are going to probably one of my favorite nonprofits in the world, which is Heroic Hearts Project, which is saving veterans' lives. They're in the U.S., they're in Canada, they're in the U.K. And I just love that mission. I have a very close spot in my heart for veterans, as you know from what we've talked about, also for first responders, because the lives are so similar. You have these long periods of lull, and then you have a crazy period of fight or flight, and the trauma involved. And so there's this just crazy mix of when you're in these positions. So Heroic Hearts is one. And then Chacruna is another one that they are focused on protecting the indigenous rights, which is also extremely important with psychedelics, especially with the plant medicines. And then the third one is the Fireside Project, which I absolutely love, because it's a peer support group for psychedelics. So if you are doing a solo journey on your own, which you should not be doing unless you're extremely experienced, but if you were and you have a moment of crisis, you can actually use their app or call their 800 number and speak to a peer that can kind of help take you through that challenging period of that journey. The book is truly all about healing, both for the people who read it and then for the proceeds going to these nonprofits.
Yeah, and another interesting thing about the Fireside Project is, you know, that idea of having someone that you can speak to in a time of perhaps existential crisis, and that you're speaking with someone who has experience, who has, you know, knows the role that they're playing and can listen and provide sound advice. And so those three organizations that you just mentioned, the Heroic Arts Project, Katrina Institute, and the Fireside Project, I do recommend that any of our listeners just take a look at them and check them out. And the Heroic Hearts Project too. Like, you know, I've spoken to the Canadian version of Heroic Hearts and David Fascino. I'm sorry, I'm saying his name wrong, but really veteran, combat veteran, really lovely guy. And the idea is that, you know, you can go in as a veteran, as a first responder. They're vetting these different retreats, vetting providers and all these different things and providing access to it. And I think that's extremely important because, and again, too, and this is something I wouldn't mind your opinion on, like, you know, people talk about this psychedelic renaissance, and I don't think people realize how at the infancy we are still, and the availability is really not existent. You know what I mean? Like, it's we're still moving forward, and there's all sorts of optimism about it. But the one thing that always bothers me is much like in Canada right now, you know, you can go through the special access program and get psilocybin prescribed to you via the federal government, but it's for end of life and palliative. And yet palliative patients are still waiting, you know, 2 years for these exclusions. And it's like, you know who doesn't have time? People who are palliative.
Yes, that group.
And you can apply that same theory to both veterans and first responders because of the rates of suicide and depression associated with that. So, you know, I really appreciate what the Heroic Hearts Project is doing, and I think it's fantastic. So
yeah, and sorry.
No, by all means, please continue.
I was just going to say Heroic Hearts Project also dear to my heart because they were the ones my partner Jenny saw Jesse Gould on a podcast, on the Warrior Soul podcast, and said to me, you have to listen to this, you have to watch this. And we watched it. And at that point, that, you know, it was like 3 years ago or something, a little longer than that, maybe. And I had never heard of ayahuasca at that point. And I was like, why are these veterans going to Peru for healing? It makes no sense to me. And that's when I started, you know, diving to the VA, the VA here in the States, and just what a horrible job. And it sounds like the equivalent VAs in other countries have the same sort of bizarre mentality of just giving you a handful of pills and saying, see you next month.
Well, yeah. And that's exactly the point. Like, you know, we've talked to veterans in the Netherlands and different places, and everyone has that same thing. It's like, they just give you more and more drugs to help you tread water. And that's all you end up doing is treading water.
Yep.
And what does that allow? It maybe gives you room to breathe, but that's it. You know what I mean? Like, there's no real forward movement with this.
Yeah, I honestly think that was best voiced by the episode we did with Sherry.
Oh, I know.
Sherry Bordage. Yeah, it was incredible hearing, like, her story and struggle with just being given medication after medication after medication and just piling on. And some of it, she's like, you know, the side effects of these are legitimately concerning. But they're like, it's approved by Health Canada, so, and the VA, so we're just going to continue to put you on them.
And in Canada, we have MAID programs, which is medically assisted dying, and the VA actually suggesting those to veterans. I know. And that thankfully turned into a very significant controversy. And I think it might actually further veterans having access to these psychedelic compounds, but how long does that take? And so, again, back to the Heroic Hearts, you know, if anyone out there is a veteran or a first responder with PTSD or any number of things, please check out the webpage and just give them a call and see, just have a conversation perhaps. Yeah. Cool.
I just want to throw in one little thing here because I had someone, I was at a psychedelic society meeting and someone asked about some woman who was just out of domestic violence relationship, and she said, you know, I think I have PTSD, but I don't think it's allowed because it's just for veterans. And I was like, okay, so no, just let's be clear. Yes, veterans, first responders definitely have, a lot of them have experienced PTSD, but any traumatic event can lead to PTSD. So it's not just veterans, first responders. It can be anyone who's experienced trauma.
And thank you for saying that, because I've actually had that conversation recently, not on the podcast, but just the idea that, I don't want to say there's elitism associated with it, because that's probably not the best word, but there is this sense of a hierarchy within what PTSD is. And I think everyone on some level has some form of PTSD, because life is hard. You know, scary things happen, car accidents, shit, a dog barks at you when you're a kid and elicits some fear response inside you. And that can change the way you think and the way you adapt and the way you cope as your life progresses. And so, you know, I think everyone has PTSD. And even me, like, you know, in speaking with various people throughout the psychedelic community, people are like, oh, you know, thank you for your service. And I'm like, I'm not a veteran. And they're like, well, you're a first responder. And I'm like, yeah, but that's different. I've never been in active combat. And even to me, I'm like, the PTSD of a veteran is worse than the PTSD of a first responder. And then you can take that a step further and say, well, that's worse than the PTSD of someone in a car accident. And then you just have this hierarchical structure where people at the bottom are constantly comparing themselves to the severity of the people above them. And I think it is wise to say is that, you know, something that I've learned over being a paramedic for 20 years is that people's emergencies are their own. Their subjective interpretation of the traumatic event that they experience is unique to themselves. And it's difficult to have this comparison and have it even be valid for that matter. You know, like, far be it for me to suggest that someone who's a survivor of domestic violence is any more or less significant in their PTSD than a first responder would be, you know?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Two brilliant things you say there. One is comparison syndrome. We do it in everything, you know, but we typically talk about it. Oh, like, oh, my neighbor's car is better than mine. Yeah. But it's same thing with trauma. I mean, oh, that person's trauma is way worse than mine, so I don't deserve the treatment. No. And it comes back to, you know, Dr. Peter Levine, Dr. Gabor Mate, basically just what you just said. Everybody has experienced trauma. There's just no question of it. And whether it's what I like to refer to of the thousand little paper cuts of trauma that build up until it explodes out, or whether it's that one or two big traumatic experiences, but we all have it. And as you said, it could even be like Dr. Matei tells a story about how he was given, his mom gave him up when he was a baby to a stranger on the street, or quasi acquaintance on the street, because they were afraid the Nazis were going to take their family and exterminate them. And he was reunited with his mom, I can't remember, maybe 6 weeks later, a certain period of time. But it wasn't until, I think, his 60s, he was on this beautiful indigenous psilocybin retreat in Canada, and he had this vision, and he recalled this event. He saw himself as this baby being passed off, and he all of a sudden had this realization that all these years he was struggling to be the best in his field, to be the most well-known and well-loved doctor. It all came from this feeling of abandonment as a baby, where he wasn't even consciously aware of it. So yeah, you know, trauma, we have experienced trauma in our lives, no question.
Well, and it's funny too, because, like, you know, most, I can say professionals, for lack of a better term here, would suggest that, you know, children don't start forming memories till 2.5-3 years old. And my daughter's 18 months. She has a very significant memory. She knows what she's doing. She remembers things. She's developing the relationships. I don't get how that seems to be sort of this benchmark for that you can't really have trauma below that age because you don't really remember it. I'm like, well, okay, even if you didn't, your body remembers it. This is, you know, having these traumas at such a young age. And, you know, when you're developing and formulating, you know, relationships and understanding, it's quite significant. But I guess we're digressing just ever so slightly right now. So I wouldn't mind having a bit of a conversation about microdosing, because, you know, I've talked about microdosing before, and I fall into that same trap that a lot of people do in the psychedelic community, where it's like, let's talk about big experiences and, you know, a bunch of mushrooms and a bunch of this. And those have their place and they are extremely relevant. But so let's just talk about microdosing. What is a microdose? and move on from there.
Yeah. So typically people microdose with psilocybin or LSD just because they're the most available, but you can microdose with any psychedelic medicine. It's 1/5 to 1/10 of a full dose of that medicine. And what we say is it's a sub-perceptual experience, which means you will typically experience very little. Certainly won't experience any psychedelic type experiences. You'll be able to go through your day, no problem. There are absolutely no side effects that I'm aware of with any kind of microdosing. And with microdosing, the idea is you still get these incredible benefits that we're learning about psychedelics. To me, the coolest, geekiest aspect of that is the neuroplasticity that we're now seeing in the research, that even with microdosing, even with these small amounts, it's still affecting the neuroplasticity. It's still allowing the brain to make new connections. And that's what we're talking about, the brain to grow through psychedelics. And so there are several different protocols you can use with microdosing. Typically, there are flights, so you do 2 days on, 1 day off, or 1 day on, 2 days off, or 3 and 2, and all sorts of different variations. The reason you do that is let's say you do 1 day on, so you have the full dose, 1 day off, you have a half dose, it's sort of reducing, and then either do the third day back on, a full dose, or you let that third day be a neutral day, where it's totally gone from your system, and then the next day you do a full dose and you go on that way. You typically do flights for about 1 month, and then you take a week or two off. And if you are seeing success, you might go back on microdosing at that point. Just like with any psychedelic experience, I strongly suggest the three-prong kind of approach to this, which is the first step is preparation. So doing your research, you know, what you might want to, even there are now, you know, so many microdosing coaches or academies out there. So you could consider doing that. You can certainly do your research on your own. You certainly don't need a coach for microdosing, but you might for the process of integration, which I'll get to in a minute. So preparation is doing your research, finding the medicine, possibly finding a coach. I talk about building your community at this phase. So having people that you can talk to about psychedelics is a big issue because, you know, I know in my family and my old circle of friends, I would say psychedelics and some people would be like, oh yeah. And other people would be like,
yeah, crickets,
you know, pin drop, whatever. Yeah. But and there's a great story in the book. It's not microdosing, but there's a great story in the book about this guy, Charles, who didn't have community. In fact, his community was a group of drug addicts. He was in this kind of bad crowd, bad situation. And he came out of his psychedelic experience with the medicine telling him, you don't need these drugs. You are completely healed. You have the tools within you to heal yourself. Go live your life. And he got out of this journey and he's like, oh my God, this is amazing. But all the people around him were doing heroin. They're like, I don't care about this. I just want to do my next, you know, next shot. And so he actually wanted to do a more downward spiral without having these people to talk to. So community is so important. There are online communities like empathic.health. There are psychedelic societies all around the world where you can join. A lot of them are still doing Zoom, so you can even join one that's not even near you. I belong to like 6 psychedelic societies all across the world. and then you decide the protocol you want to follow, and then you do the microdosing. The second part is the actual physical taking the medicine every day, whatever your protocol you're going to follow. And then the third part of this experience is integration. And integration I'm not even sure who coined that word, but integration is simply making note of what you're experiencing during the microdosing. So do you feel you have more creativity? Do you have more energy? Are you thinking more clearly? These are some of the typical benefits we see with microdosing. But we're also seeing things like breaking OCD habits, breaking those patterns that you can't get out of. We're seeing it reduce anxiety. So there are so many benefits from microdosing. Some people are also using microdosing to wean off of these horrible drugs we just talked about, these pharmaceuticals. That, again, you'd want to have a coach for that to make sure you're doing it the proper way. But that's another tool that people are using for microdosing. So it's a very safe protocol. It's a little easier to get the medicine. I'm not still quite sure how that works, but it still blows my mind that there are several websites you can go to where you can buy microdosing capsules and have it shipped to your house.
Like in Canada, you can go on and there's probably like 70 of them. Now, that being said,
so it's kind of funny that you guys mentioned this, because I have I have somebody who reached out to me specifically just to get some information, and they had purchased some of this online from, I think, British Columbia, and they showed me the capsules and the packaging, and I'm like, your capsule looks incredibly white to have, you know, fungi material in it. And then I'm reading the package and it's like full of, I think niacin and, mostly just lions. Niacin. It's mostly that and lion's
I'm
mane.
I'm very flushed. Don't understand.
So I just kind of was laughing, cause I was like, and you felt nothing? And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, it's probably cause you're just getting a really nice dose of niacin and, lion's mane. It's probably why you feel tingly. But
for our Canadian viewers, Organic Shrooms Canada, is vetted by some people I know that are mycologists, and I generally refer people to them if they're looking for the microdoses. And again, too, like when it comes down to it, is that there's work to this, right? Like you don't just go and find some mushrooms and start microdosing. And I will say that a good resource is the Microdosing Institute. And they have all kind of like the, you know, the different protocols, which can be a little bit complicated. You know what I mean? Like, you know, to me, I'm just like, hey, every other day. Easy peasy. But then there's like, you know, these somewhat convoluted things. But, you know, and each one has its own relevance to it.
Randall, just one question that I had for you, because I don't know if you actually touched on it, but just to kind of circle back to it, you said subperceptual dosing. What is that dose? Is it 100 milligrams of plant material? Is it 500 milligrams? Is it a gram? Obviously, it varies depending on the individual and their experience.
We need to clarify this, yeah.
But what would be like a baseline protocol for most people in terms of a dose they should take?
Well, of course, it depends on the medicine, but we say 5 to 10%. So for psilocybin, it would be, a 1 milligram. So a gram is kind of a standard, it's a very low dose for a macro journey, but that's kind of the standard. So it would be typically a micro dose would be 1/10 of that. So 1 milligram of the psilocybin.
Or
with
like
LSD though, yeah. It's a much smaller, you know, you wouldn't want to do even 1 milligram.
Oh God, you would be so insanely high. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it depends. So you have to know the medicine and how it's measured to get to that. But if you look at, you know, the macro, the lowest macro level of that medicine, and 1/10 of that, or sometimes up to 1/5, would be the microdose.
And I think it's also safe to say too that most people who are microdosing will be microdosing on psilocybin cubensium mushrooms, which are the most easiest to cultivate, and they're generally between 10 and 12 milligrams of psilocybin per gram, and then a microdose based on that scale will be between probably 100 milligrams to 200 milligrams. And if you push that a little bit higher, that's your prerogative, but I think that's a safe to bet for a sub-psychedelic dose. And now another thing that's interesting about psilocybin too is that you have this temporary period of desensitivity. And so if Randall and I did 5 grams of mushrooms and laughed our pants off and had a great old time, and the next day we're like, let's do that again, you would, you know, subjectively have to do double the amount. So that's one unique thing with microdosing, is that you can stagger and increase your doses. But I just keep in mind that if you had a period of cessation for like 3 or 4 days and you maybe went back up to that staggered dose, you would have more of a feeling than you did when you stopped, which is something that I feel like most people aren't super familiar with. But
and you know, and the other thing with microdosing is you might not experience anything. There's a great story in the book about Danielle, who was, I think it was Danielle. I don't believe in microdosing, but I'm going to test it on myself. She's a scientist. And so she did microdose psilocybin, and she did it for 30 days for a month. And, she's like, nope, no effect whatsoever. Didn't feel anything. And then a week later, she's walking her dog, and she has this severe anxiety attack about something bad's going to happen to her dog, like, immediately. And she realized that for the past month that she was microdosing, she did not have one of those anxiety-filled moments. And so it was this sort of a dawn. And that's why, again, why integration is so important, to look back, because all of a sudden she realized, oh my gosh, the microdosing was working, because right. That was one of the, she had this, most of the time, she said, even with anxiety medicine, she had these moments of just fear, this irrational fear that something was going to happen to her dog. So you might not, during those 30 days, you might feel nothing. But that's why the integration is so important, journaling, however you want to do it, making voice recordings, whatever way, but just thinking that it's not, as you said, Adam, it's not a magic pill. You have to do the work. You have to go inside yourself and look at that. I will say, on my personal experience, microdosing psilocybin versus LSD, LSD was like a Mustang, where the psilocybin was like an old Chevy. So
that's an interesting experience. Fair enough. But, well, and it's funny that you were saying, when you were talking about people's, I guess, anecdotes, for lack of a better term, about microdosing. And I know about 40 people microdosing right now. And there's a very consistent, like, self-awareness is a really hard thing to have. And most people think they have it, but, like most things, it's varied and scaled and subjective. But I feel like the vast majority of people who microdose, it's like, well, nothing's going on, but I'll stick with it for a little bit. And then, one very specific moment is a friend of mine who's very, I'm going to say spazzy, but reactive. And she was driving her car, and she was cut off, and she had her kid in the back. And normally she would lose her mind, chase this person down, confront them, key their car, I don't know, something. And I guess she didn't even notice for like 10 minutes. And all of a sudden she's like, I didn't even care. I was fine with it. And then all of a sudden, because, it'd been like weeks of like, this isn't doing anything. I'm like, well, stick with it or don't. But you got to give something a chance. A month, I think, is a reasonable amount of time. And then the polar opposite is of a friend of mine who, he's got alcoholism. He's got dementia, unfortunately, which is rather tragic. And he's a really highly intelligent guy. And he's listening to the podcast, and he was like, hey man, I want to try microdosing. And I'm like, sure. And I gave him the information how to acquire it. And then he told me the day he was going to do it. And he was like, I'm taking one now, and I'm going to take one before I go to bed. And then the next day in the afternoon, he called me and he was like, hey, I took it, and I woke up the morning at 6 a.m. as I always do. I had my coffee, I did my morning routine, and I didn't realize till much later on in the afternoon that I just didn't have a cigarette. I didn't even think to have one, that involuntary response being like, I need some nicotine right now. And now he's like, yeah, he's like, I'm just calm. I'm collected. I don't have this urgency or desire to blame things around me for circumstances. And I think that's a really good example of what microdosing can provide, of psilocybin anyways.
Good.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've microdosed off, 5-MeO-DMT. And Ibogaine, LSD, and psilocybin. And, Ibogaine is wonderful to microdose on. A little bit more obscure and a little bit more difficult to acquire. And do your research if you ever want to do that, because there's a little bit more to it. It can build up in your liver. It can have issues as you progress over time with it. You really have to be on, schedule. But it is unique that each one of them offers a slightly different thing. So when you say LSD is like a Mustang and psilocybin is like, Tempo or something. Elaborate on that. I'm curious to know your reason.
So I I think my first experience with psychedelics, ironically, now that I think about it, was with microdosing with psilocybin, because it was, even then, it was somewhat easy to access compared to certainly the macrodose. Although, of course, the irony is you can buy a bottle of microdose capsules and combine them into a macrodose, but that's
right. No one talk about that. Yeah,
that's not helping that. Yeah. So with the psilocybin, I think my problem was I had too high expectations, and that's one of the issues we have with psychedelics. Is the mantra is have an intention but don't have expectations, because expectations are going to set you up for possible disappointment. So I guess I was expecting with the psilocybin, yeah, that I would be like, oh my gosh, I had this brilliant thought, or even better, if I had a bad habit, like, I don't need to have that glass of wine anymore. I don't need to have that cigarette. But I tried it in the morning. I tried it in the evening. I tried different times a day. And I just, I felt some improved self-awareness and I knew the health benefits, so I was happy with it, but it just wasn't not my medicine, I don't think, at least for microdosing. For LSD, so I took, I was like, well, when I was writing the book, I was like, well, I was getting to this kind of gnarly point in the book where I was, trying to grind out the last editing and all these things. So I said, well, I'm going to, do a little microdosing with the LSD to sort of help get this over the edge. And, the LSD I felt on that first day, I mean, there's no question. The LSD is like, I'm here. And it was just like this gentle hand on my back the whole time I was microdosing, just gently pushing me. And it's the only way I can describe it. It was definitely had enhanced creativity. I had enhanced insight. My wife joked like, okay, no more LSD for about a year. You need to calm down.
You're too creative. Like,
yeah. So, and so that's my other big point is I think different medicine, people need to find a medicine. So if you try whatever you try for, whether a macro or micro dose, and it doesn't work for you, look at another psychedelic that might do the trick for you. Some people, psilocybin is the one and only and the most beautiful. I have a friend who talks about psilocybin as like his best friend. They joke with him in his journey. Mm-hmm. The mushrooms tease him, and I'm like, okay, that never happened to me, but
I can actually relate to that. I understand what he's talking about. Yeah,
that must be your medicine too, though.
Well, and it's funny too. Like I started off with ibogaine. Well, I guess as a teenager in high school, we were doing LSD and mushrooms. But there's something very interesting about doing it as an adolescent. Maybe the reasoning for why you're doing it is subtly different, because my experiences do not even remotely parallel what they are now as an adult. But, I started off with ibogaine and then psilocybin. We had this very significant relationship for several years that very much elevated our dosing and got quite acquainted with one another. And then ayahuasca and then 5-MeO-DMT. And you know what I mean? Like it is very specific that, each medicine, each psychedelic, whatever you want to refer to it as, resonates a little bit differently. There's a different resonating frequency within it, and it can play different roles at different points in your life. And not to suggest that I'm done with any one of these psychedelics, but each one helped me through a specific point and brought me somewhere where I needed to be, and then allowed me to move on and present with something else. And I think
been my experience too.
Yeah. I think it's really important what you just said though. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me just add one more microdosing story, because it's not in the book and I so wish it was, but this gentleman is a farmer, and he was in the middle of harvesting when I was finishing the book, and he just couldn't make the time to finish his story. But it's, again, anecdotal, but it just speaks volumes to this possibility of healing. So his wife had a stroke, and about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, and they, for a year, they did the traditional occupational therapy, physical therapy. She was paralyzed in her left side of her body. And so about a year ago, they said, well, they went to some conference or somewhere. You know, it's always funny how people find out about psychedelics.
Serendipitous, to some extent.
Yeah. Yes, very, very yeah. much so. And so someone said, well, maybe you should try microdosing. Have your wife try microdosing. And so as we, he was relating a story last fall, they had this major breakthrough where for the first time, and again, it might've been just how long the process took or whatever. Or I like to think it's the microdosing, the psilocybin, but for the first time she could start moving just the tips of her fingers. And you know, whether a year from now it progresses to more, time will tell. But again, that shows me the power of that, again, of the psychedelics in the brain with this neuroplasticity, that it can even make maybe just minor, maybe more, maybe bigger repairs to even stroke victims. And so I think about, you know, your friend with, you know, the dementia and same thing. It's like, you know, these we don't know yet. I mean, we know we have a history from, you know, from centuries ago, thousands of years of history in these indigenous cultures, but we don't have the brain scans that we until, you know, more recently. And now we're seeing these brain scans and the, I mean, they just are amazing to look at. And it's like, and that's why it just gets me back to this, back on my soapbox or about my back on my mountaintop. Like, why have we been lied to about these medicines when, you know, these were, LSD was being used for therapy in the 1960s and used extremely successfully. The founder of Alcoholics Anonymous used LSD right? to help, yeah. help him yeah. cure his alcohol abuse addiction. You know, so it's like, we have all this, and so it's just so promising. And so if microdosing is a way to get people to feel safely to come into this fear and try these medicines, then I think it's a wonderful choice.
Well, and sorry, just to hop on, when you were talking about your friend who had a CVA, or a stroke, and the neurological impairment that came from that, and that microdosing improved this, that's the same as my father, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And he should be dead by a year and a half ago. And he is cognitively intact. His, you know, his capacity is driving. He's interacting with my, you know, his grandchildren. And it's incredible. And we've actually interviewed a company, April 19th Discovery, which I encourage people to check out their webpage, which are looking into the neurodegenerative neuroplastic response and trying to create psychedelic compounds that aren't so psychedelic so that people with various neurodegenerative conditions can start microdosing on these. Now, add a flip to that is that, you know, I've read the articles about dimethyltryptamine, so DMT used specifically for stroke rehabilitation. And as an anecdote, kid had a traumatic event, brain damage, and the family read this article and they got an old-fashioned DMT vape pen and kid had more than a microdose. So again, do your research on this stuff. Like, it's dosing is a very relevant thing because people always have this idea. It's like, well, if I get a medication, it's in a dose that I need. I don't have to look into it. I don't have to think about it. And it's like, well, no, you really have to take responsibility for what you're doing in this space because we're probably a decade out, I would say, until we actually have, you know, medications even for, like, you know, stroke recovery or Alzheimer's and dementia, unfortunately. And there's a lot of people in the meantime who can benefit from these, but until that point, do your research, be safe, because, you know, you go in just to, I'm going to rebuild my brain, and the next thing you know, you are a fractal. It's like, oh, well, that's a slippery slope.
Yeah, you know, and I you know, they're developing an LSD that has no psychedelic effects, but it still has the brain, all the good benefits, and you know, I'm on the fence on that. I'm not a purist. I do think the plants are amazing, and I still am flabbergasted that you can make a plant illegal, as the world governments have proven to us. But, you know, but I think any way we can help heal people, and if they can make a psychedelic compound that doesn't have the psychedelic element to it but has all the benefits to it in terms of neuroplasticity and maybe even then that's something that will help with healing. I know the other side of the coin is that there are people with a psychedelic experience, you often get a spiritual element to that. And so you don't get that necessarily with microdosing. You don't get that with a with some of these newer compounds that they're trying to develop that don't have the psychedelic element to it. So that's one thing that for the big macro journey that you do get often, that's one of the underlying principles. We have, you know, people that were atheists that say, oh my God, I now know there's, I don't know what it is, I'm not going to label it, but there is definitely a creator out there and I have been put to shame. I have a priest in the book who, went to a Johns Hopkins study for religious leaders and he wasn't aware of it, but the people told him after his journey that he was speaking in tongues during his journey.
He's probably speaking Aramaic or something. It's like Sanskrit or something. Like that's
crazy.
Awesome.
Crazy.
Well, you know? I 100% agree with you. And I remember I was at a conference and there was a company there that they were working on making a non-psychedelic psychedelic. And it stuck with me. And I'm like, why are you trying to suck the life out of this? This is just typical. And I got in my own little soapbox and I wasn't being a dick or anything, but in my mind, I'm like, this is ridiculous. And then again, too, right? Like, is there much of a difference between microdosing? Because you're absolutely right. Like, do I think the world would benefit if everyone had a macrodose? Yeah, of course. But I would settle if everyone microdosed. I would settle if people could reverse the effects of Alzheimer's and dementia, and maybe Grandma Edna isn't ready for a big dose. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, I think everyone could use a psychedelic experience, but I don't think everyone is ready for one. And maybe in this life, they're never ready. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I agree. I agree 100%. And I love that. I love that. Yes. As long as they're, you know, I agree. Microdosing everybody, hopefully, and macrodosing, you know, if they're ready for it.
Well, and I do think that if people microdose, they're probably more apt to take a larger dose if they ever were going to. You know what I mean? Like it's and again, that leads back to that whole gateway nonsense. But at the same time, right, like we're working against the war on drugs. And something you said earlier is like, you know, why did the government take that stance? And I'm like, you know, the war on drugs, depending on where you want to draw the demarcation line, did it start with the advent of the Council of Nicaea and Catholicism and Constantine and the, you know, the witch trials, or did it start with the Nixon and, you know what I mean, and the Reagan administration and all this nonsense? And you're like, at the end of the day, you know, everything stems back to the same thing, is that people who think too much are difficult to control. And that's not even conspiratorial, it's just a fact. You know, like literacy was one of the biggest reasons on why we have democracy, is because people were able to share ideas and think independently and read about other people's ideas. And that, you arguably could suggest, was the catalyst for the French Revolution. You know, like Europe was a series of monarchies for the vast majority of its existence. Only recently democracies exist. I don't think people necessarily realize that. And the reason why it exists is people being able to think and speak freely. And one of the catalysts for that is psychedelics. You know what I mean? And
yeah, I agree with you. You know, the war on drugs, you know, I'm focused obviously on the Western war on drugs or the more recent one, but you're right. I mean, the Spanish, what, you know, it's all about control and fear-based. They went in when they were in Mexico and you know, the indigenous had to change the name of their cactus from Huachuma to San Pedro to try to appease the Spanish.
It's a, like, whitewash.
You know, because San Pedro, St. Peter, oh, that's okay. Yeah. You know,
we're doing this in the name of your Christian God. Yeah, right. Let's work that way. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Governments have, I pick on Nixon and that, because to me, especially when we see some of the tapes and see that it was just so racially and politically motivated. We don't, obviously the Spanish were probably that same way, but we don't have the tapes from back then to see it so bluntly in our face.
Well, and you're right too, right? Like, let's be realistic. The war on drugs is very much racially motivated, you know, at its very core, you know, being derived from a basis of, like, you know, anti-Latino and anti-African-American, and it's, you know, and that's a continuation with that. And so right now, when you're looking, let's say maybe high level at sort of this psychedelic renaissance, you know, what are your thoughts on how this proceeds? And I know this is a very open-ended question, but I'm just curious from your perspective, like, you've you've been talking to people, you've integrated yourself, you're involved in these communities and everything. You know, where are we at right now? How fast is the pulse on this?
I have these waves where I get extremely hopeful and then I talk to someone and it drops back down. So I'm actually on a wave myself right now. But, you know, we're looking at kind of a three-legged stool of psychedelics. We have the decriminalization movement, which says that, you know, all plants should be made legal. It's ridiculous that we have these rules. Like, you know, you can grow, like, by the way, just a little aside, speaking of San Pedro, you know, you drive up and down Southern California and everybody has a San Pedro cactus in their front yard and it's hilarious and it's perfectly legal. It's only illegal if you cut open that San Pedro to get the, or get the mescaline. So it's just funny. So decriminalization is one movement. It seems to have slowed down greatly. And I was actually speaking to a psychedelic lawyer the other day, and he said, decrim has kind of died because it's been labeled as woke. And that extremely annoyed.
Labeled by woke as sort of the right wing? Or how? I personally don't see how that's woke.
It seemed like it was the right. To me, there's only one good way of woke. I mean, if you understand that we certainly have evidence of this in Canada and in the U.S. of just how we've treated the indigenous people, putting them in these schools and things like that. So, you know, to me, I'm kind of proud to be woke of that I know my history. I don't feel, you know, guilt over it, which I guess is the controversy. Like, I don't feel guilt that, you know, my ancestors came from Norway, and I'm sure they were probably doing bad things to the indigenous there, but I don't have any knowledge of that. So to me, woke is kind of a badge of honor that I am aware of our history, and I'm aware that we have done some horrible things. I mean, all of us, in the name of something, civilization or power or whatever.
And yeah, that's a relevant statement too. And I'm like, and again, this goes back in all sorts of different conversation topics, but, like, you know, I'm of, like, European descent as well, obviously. And you're right. I think woke can be simply defined as recognizing our history, reading our history and understanding it and not denying it. But this idea of being guilted by it and feeling shame about what my ancestors have done is very counterintuitive, and it doesn't move us forward. It stagnates us and then puts us into this very conflicted state. And I feel like, unfortunately, is that a very small group project that mentality of self-shame, and then certain people of various political spectrums take that and then define woke movement as that. And it's like, no, simply just being aware. Like, I'm aware that being a white male in North America of a heterosexual inclination is actually a very good thing to be. It's given me a lot of benefits. And I recognize that, and I'm not shamed by it, which is, yeah, you know, an interesting thing.
Yeah, same with the book. Like, you know, at one hand, I had a little bit, you know, psychedelics has been kind of traditionally dominated by white males because, again, are just sort of the, however you want to word it, the where we are in culture. But that's one of the reasons why most of the storytellers are either women or in the BIPOC community, because I really wanted all those voices out there. It wasn't a guilt. It was more, hey, I'm aware of this situation, so I want to...
I did notice that, and I actually appreciate the fact that there was sort of a multi-ethnicity, you know, gender dispersion, where it wasn't all just one specific group, you know, because let's be realistic, there's a specific perspective of the world that really isn't related to the vast majority of people, which is sort of an interesting conversation. But yeah, sorry to go back to the whole decriminalizing. I've been following that, and I did sort of notice that the posts, you know, have slowed down a little bit, but I didn't realize that it's grinding down now and has become sort of like a partisan issue, where it's now decriminalized nature is reflective and brought into the political sphere, and now is considered taboo or unwanted by the right? Because I really thought everyone was coming together on this. That's actually
kind of sucks. I know. Well, of course, within the group itself, there was controversy because, you know, decrim nature by its wording, by its definition means, you know, all plants. But then there was some people within that group who were like, and within psychedelics themselves were like, well, wait a second. We need to do some, we need to have a special category for peyote because it's an extremely slow growing cactus. It is deeply part of the indigenous culture, their ceremonies. And so can we just have like a little asterisk, you know, everything illegal, everything decriminalized but peyote. And then the others were like, well, no, let's just protect the peyote plant. Like they've just done that now. There's a nonprofit, there's at least one nonprofit, if not several, that have bought land in that Texas, Mexico area where peyote grows. And so, but I get it. So it's like, I respect that, you know, if I were offered peyote, unless it was offered by an indigenous person, I wouldn't accept it. I would wait for the mezcal, and, you know, from the San Pedro.
But, well, and that's what I mean. Like, you don't need to take peyote.
Right.
Exactly. You can get synthetic. And if you're a purist and you only want natural, then San Pedro. There's actually Peruvian torch. There's several cacti that contain mescaline. You don't have to be a dick about it. You know what I mean? Like, this is someone else's thing. Exactly. Their culture is integrally associated with it. And that's another thing, too, when it comes down to this, is like, you know, when you're talking about the Chicuna Institute and it's protecting, you know, indigenous populations and their traditional use for it, and I completely understand that. But it is an interesting thing that, you know, LSD is a very psychedelic, you know, it's very effective. There's other psychedelics, and even like an Amanita muscaria and different things that... You don't have to go digging in someone's culture and take this up, but yet somehow ayahuasca has become, you know, yeah, and already we've sort of bastardized the use of it because ayahuasca, technically, in my understanding, I could be wrong, and if someone wants to correct me, feel free, was that a shaman takes it to heal their participant, not I take it as a participant and then have my own journey. And so I'm like, and to me, it's this culture. It's Western culture, which is based on consumption, amalgamation, assimilation. You know what I mean? Like we just, that's what we do as a culture. And part of me thinks that psychedelics can actually help mitigate that or change that if enough people do. And when, whether you believe as a collective we can change if enough people tip the scale or just simply providing awareness, but I don't know a better way of becoming aware of something other than doing a bunch of psychedelics because it makes you very... I don't know, not selfish, being able to empathetically view the world as a whole as opposed to through the lens of a single individual, which is sort of a pretty important thing.
Yeah, I mean, I love this quote from a veteran friend of mine who said, you know, if we all took psychedelics, there'd be no war because we'd all realize we're fighting our brothers and our sisters and it's ridiculous. Why are we fighting our brothers and our sisters? And, you know, that was... doesn't sound that profound, but to me that was pretty profound because that is our, you know, we, when you do this true, you know, the bigger psychedelic experience, you do see your tiny little space in this vast world. And you also see that we're all interconnected and, you know, it is a beautiful, beautiful thing to have that experience and to understand that. So
yeah, and I don't think that that's a ridiculous statement at all. Like the United States government thought that true enough to actually ban, like, let's be realistic, the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement in the eyes of that specific administration, even though it transpired several political administrations, was because LSD was making people not want to fight. You know what I mean? That was a big part of it. And you're absolutely right, is that it's really hard to make people go kill other people that they have no issue with or no qualm with when people are doing psychedelics, because you're absolutely right. You can empathize so deeply with other people and recognize that we're all humans. We all have the same struggles. Yes, we have different cultures, but fundamentally we are the same thing.
But again, a lot of this kind of harkens back to the conservative playbook of not following something because wokeism, has become popular. So that's why we're seeing it circle back.
Well, it's identity politics.
But right? I will say, sorry, because we got way off topic. Great conversation. Did we finish all three of the legs to the stool?
No, okay. Did we finish any legs to the stool?
Sorry, I have to be that guy, unfortunately.
What stool? What are we talking about?
So we hit decriminalization, and then we got two more legs, right?
Yeah. So then the second leg is through the therapy prescription model, which is taking place and starting to grow in Australia and you have some of that in Canada. U.S. not there yet, but I just heard Rick Doblin talking the other day, and I thought it was going to be sooner, but now he's talking maybe 2024 for MDMA to finally be approved by the FDA for very specific therapy. So again, we're opening, like you said, at the beginning of the podcast, Adam, you're exactly right. You know, we're 1% into that. So this approval by the FDA, assuming it happens, opens the door, you know, 5% maybe, but maybe by getting our foot in the door, that then allows us to keep pushing and pushing the door the rest of the way open.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's going to be precipitous in that sense where you have this cascading effect. And I really hope you're right. Yeah,
I really hope so. I mean, again, LSD has such a bad reputation, including this Life magazine article, cover story about, you know, the horror of LSD, which I think is funny because it came about a decade after they did this great cover story about the gloriousness of psilocybin.
Yeah, with Gordon Wasson and his wife.
A decade later, they went,
total 180. And you're like,
But, you know, we have this, like I said, we have this history from the 60s of all this positivity. So I'm hoping that does, but it has so much negative connotation with the Timothy Leary and the counterculture. But I'm hopeful about that. I'm surprised by MDMA because, again, this is the pure form of the medicine, not the ecstasy, which is often cut with other things. But I'm still surprised because that's, you know, had a label of the party drug. So I'm amazed with that reputation. It's still getting, hopefully we'll get a.
Well, it was a therapeutic before it was a party drug. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, and that's what blows my mind. Right. Yeah. Is that, you know, it just got appropriated as a party drug. And I've done it at raves in the late 90s and it's wonderful. Let's be able to say, but you know, that's the thing is that it was a very powerful therapeutic, much like LSD was, like revolutionary. And then all of a sudden, due to a variety of different reasons, got caught up in the war on drugs and then became this prohibited item that was unfortunately targeted for decades of misinformation. So sorry, we have a stool, we have two legs.
Yes, and the third leg is the what I call the church leg, which is you know, there's a brand new, fairly new church here in the U.S. with a kind of a novel compound, the
Psilocybin.
But there are several indigenous churches that you can legally, they fought their battle through the Supreme Court in the States, and you can legally have psychedelic ceremonies in there. With this new church, I'm thinking, well, we might see more of those spring up because, again, those methods are all the safest methods in my mind because then the medicine's out in the open. If it's a prescription, it's going to be the exact dosage, just what Adam you were mentioning earlier about, you know, watch those dosages because I just heard from someone that even gets the microdoses capsules from a very reliable source in Canada. And they measure the capsules and it's supposed to be 0.5 or I can't remember the exact dosage or 50. I can't remember the exact dose. Anyway, each one is underdosed by its 0.48 versus 0.50. So, you know, even there, the dosage is not quite right.
Well, and yeah, that's the difference between a pharmaceutical giant putting millions and millions of dollars into production and, you know, some guys who want to help the world and they're grinding in a coffee grinder and putting into like, you know, a capsule maker.
But I'm hopeful for these three avenues because, you know, as we've talked about earlier, you know, the you either have the scammers where you, you know, give them a couple hundred dollars and you never get anything, or you have the scammers that you actually get something, but
it's flour. God knows
what it is exactly. And so at least if we, you know, if we get it decriminalized or legalized or in a therapy model or through the church, it's at least you have more opportunity to do your research. You know, I went to an underground ayahuasca center in the States. Obviously no website, no anything. So it's kind of hard to do your research.
Yeah, it really is.
I did talk to some people that had gone there. So I had some word of mouth. I did do a Zoom with the healer / facilitator, and he seemed pretty normal on the Zoom. But he ended up being quite a different person in person. And the medicine experience was absolutely beautiful. But I spent most of my time there actually being a therapist, in a sense, or a coach for a couple of people that were traumatized by this healer. And so you stress the research as much as possible, especially while we're in this kind of weird gray phase.
Transitionary period, which I think is going to last a lot longer than people expect. And again, it's going to be, you know, and another thing too that I don't think people realize is that people are treating psychedelics as a medical compound, you know, as a pharmaceutical drug, like an SSRI or, you know, cardiac medication. And I think as this progresses and moves forward, we're going to have to grapple with the entire sense of spirituality that's associated with this. You know, religions have been created over this. This is the impetus, you know, in some schools of thought for the evolution of our consciousness, and how those things are going to wrap together harmoniously and then be fit into the box that is modern Western medicine. You know what I mean? I'm like, this is a jigsaw puzzle. You know what I mean? And it's profoundly complicated, like everything. But again, you know, I think this is going to take some trial and error. And I'm quite confident that we're going to make it out the other end, because I don't think, if there's ever a time in our recent history when we need this more, it's now.
Well, I mean, if you look at cannabis legalization in Canada, it took almost 17 years from when the first bill was signed in 2001 for medical use. And then it finally evolved into legalization in 2018.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if that even gives us somewhat sense of where we're going with this, we've got some time ahead of us.
I think
right?
that was the first reckoning of laws set up that weren't based on reality. You know what I mean? Like, and it took a while for people to change the groupthink that was associated with this and the brainwashing. And I'm hoping that a precedent's been set. You know, in Canada, they're being lobbied, they're being sued. There's all sorts of things going on right now. And there seems to be bipartisan support for psychedelics and use for veterans in the States. Like, and very much with veterans. I think veterans are going to open
especially
the door
veterans,
for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if there's something that the left and right can agree on, it's got to be veterans. You know what I mean? Like, if they can't agree on that, then there's some significant issues going on. Oh, and one other thing too, the Church of Salemithoxen, which I may or may not belong to, so they don't actually have religious exemption, do they? I think that are they setting this up as sort of like, try us and then we're going to roll with this kind of concept? Like,
you know, that I just know that both founders are lawyers.
They know what they're doing.
Experienced lawyers in the psychedelic field. So I haven't looked at how they've labeled. I mean, they call themselves the church, but I haven't looked at the legal paperwork or whatever behind that. But again, I mean, I think they paused membership right now because there's a little controversy.
Yeah, I know. I read about
week,
that.
Scientific study came out and all that.
Yeah.
I love what they're doing. Yeah, I'm a member. I got my sacrament in the mail.
Right.
It's pretty awesome.
I thought it was quite nice too. Like I tried it as a microdose, I think like 200 milligrams, and I was walking the dogs and all of a sudden I'm just like, it was just like, psst. And I'm like, ooh, quiet. I'm like, that the old mind just turned off a little bit. I'm like, wasn't that lovely? And just for all intents and purposes, salomethoxin is, I'm going to call it a novel compound, because I believe Shulgin sort of had synthesized it, or at least, synthesized it, and then postulated that if you fed psilocybin mycelium 5-MeO-DMT-HCl, that they would convert the psilocybin into salomethoxin, which is sort of this interesting analog of psilocybin and 5-MeO-DMT, which is actually pretty awesome. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing how that whole thing with their church moves forward and if they actually are able to be granted some sort of religious exemption. And even the idea of, like, you know, having a psilocybin mushroom producing novel compounds by mixing with another psychedelic is actually, you know, pretty amazing. I think it's super cool.
So, and you know, and that's the other, I know we're kind of getting near the end of time, but that's the other cool thing that's happening in psychedelics is, you know, if you look at some of the stories in the book, you know, and I think you're a little more of a psychonaut than I am, but I've only done, you know, one psychedelic at a time. But if you look at some of these stories, some of these retreats, and these are people went to the retreat center. So they were all, you know, in a legal setting with experienced people. But like Ryan, the Marine we were talking about earlier, he did Ibogaine with 5-MeO-DMT as a chaser kind of thing. And another woman, Allison, who is a Navy SEAL wife, did MDMA with psilocybin. And so it's really interesting, this new, now, you know, we're kind of mixing these and seeing what will the mix, what will the combination result, what kind of healing, what kind of transformations will happen through these combinations. And that's, to me, also very fascinating.
And again, too, is educate yourself. Because I remember I did ayahuasca one night, and a significant amount of ayahuasca one night. And the next morning, I did 5-MeO-DMT. And because I thought, what a wonderful way to prime yourself by having this profound experience. And what I didn't think about and what I figured out afterwards is that, well, the MAO inhibitor from the ayahuasca, based on half-life, was probably 1/5 to 1/6 still present in my body. And I did like probably 32 milligrams of synthetic 5-MeO-DMT and had a complete absolute ego dissolution and was in that place. For me, time was meaningless, but my wife was like, okay, it's been, you know, it's half an hour, it's 45 minutes, it's an hour, it's an hour and a half, it's 2 hours, holy shit, it's 3 hours, like, what's going on? And people die. People have died from that. So it's, you know, I think that psychedelics are actually some of the safest compounds comparative to what we view as like Western medicine. You know, read the LD50, read the side effects. There's no comparison between the two, but that doesn't mean that somehow we're absolved from our personal responsibility of understanding what we're doing. And if you want to experiment, I encourage it. However, yeah, read Randall's book. You know, it's a great place to start. And again, your book's awesome.
It's super cool. Randall, again, for our listeners out there, the title of that book?
Triumph Over Trauma.
Triumph Over Trauma. And where can our listeners find your book? Is it sold in any local bookstores or is it predominantly online?
It's predominantly online just because the way book operations work these days. But yeah, Amazon.
Yeah, I got mine on Amazon. Yeah. It was relatively seamless process, bought on Amazon, came to my house like 4 days later.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually in my local library, but I think that's just because they know me. I mean, I was kind of blown away by that. I was like, whoa, do you know what this book is about?
You're a national treasure now, Randall. So just accept that. And so is there anything else that you're doing right now? Like any appearances, any talks, other books, literary masterpieces you're producing that you want to talk about or anything?
I'm just two things. One, I'm just really excited about the MAPS conference coming to Denver in June, and big psychedelic conference. A lot of heavy hitters, a lot of celebrities, which I'm kind of mixed on. On one hand, I like it because it promotes psychedelics, but on the other hand, I don't like it because it might promote psychedelics more recreationally than intentionally. And there's, again, nothing wrong with the recreational, but that's what kind of got us in trouble in the 60s and 70s. Yeah. So I'm kind of like,
I feel they lead to the same place. You know what I mean? But like, but at the same time, it can be, I agree with what you're saying. Yeah.
I mean, I had someone tell me they did a recreational dose, not accidentally. Maybe they said accidentally, but it turned out to be this beautiful healing journey, but everyone else was just like, oh yay, colors. And they went to this deep journey and had this great healing. So even recreationally, be prepared. You might experience something that's not just all colors and great sounds and things like that.
Well, and you're at a music festival and you're having like this profound spiritual experience, and maybe that works for you, but it also puts you in a position of vulnerability. So,
yes. And that's such a rude point we haven't talked about, but just real quickly, set and setting is so important. If you're going to do this psychedelic, you are going to be very vulnerable, and you should be in a very safe place. That's why, you know, raves aren't the best thing for that, but, you know, comfy, you know, my favorite places were, you know, on my sofa with a nice blanket, because psilocybin does crazy things to my body temperature.
Doesn't it though? I get cold, very cold.
Yeah, very cold. But then I get hot later. So it's like weird. It's, you know, or my bedroom or my deck, but it's surrounded by safe things. And, ideally, again, a sober partner at the minimum, if you're doing a macro journey. Anyway, so the conference is going to be fantastic. A lot of thought leaders. I'm looking forward to seeing people and hugging them that I've only seen from their chest up from all the Zoom meetings we're having and Zoom conversations. The other thing I'm working on is, I've been in the wellness area for like 20 years, first starting on my own journey and then realizing even there, the lies we've been told about sugar and salt and fat and all these things. And so the healing kind of is the next phase of that. But while I was working on this current book, I realized that a lot of people were getting additional healing from other modalities. Meditation, you can get to a altered state of consciousness by certain meditation, by breath work. You can
holotropic breathing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm working on a new project that I'm calling Holistic with a W. And because if you look at where the word heal comes from, it's Old English, which means to become whole.
Yeah.
And plus holistic with the H is sort of, again, has a little bit of negative connotation as woo woo, you know, we need the pharmaceuticals. Now, anyway, so I'm working on this. It's going to be a video project and probably another book. And I'm in some very, very tiny discussions with some documentarians to try to get them interested in this, because my whole thing is if any way I can get the word out, that's why I so appreciate you, Adam, because any way I can get this word out that we can find healing, it's right in our grasp.
Yeah,
and it's so much better to rediscover who you really are than to be medicated. And you're, like you said, you're still able to live. I mean, that's a good thing about the pharmaceuticals. But you're not living your true authentic life unless you heal from this trauma that, as we started at the beginning of the podcast, we've all experienced. So,
yeah, well said. That's, you know, I 100% agree with that. And that's, you know, what a great way to end the podcast. I don't even want to say anything else.
Just, I know, that's
just
fair.
Like, leave on a high note. Boom, shut down.
But also, let's remind me again, those charity foundations or the foundations that you're involved with or are promoting on the show there, so we can link them in the show notes.
So Heroic Hearts Project, great, great organization, saving veterans' lives. Chikruna Institute, which is, again, focusing on protecting indigenous cultures' rights in the psychedelic field, and then the Fireside Project, which is a peer support line, which is just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I really like the idea of the Fireside. Not that the other foundations aren't great, it's just I like the idea and the concept of being able to connect and reach out with somebody wherever you are for that integration piece, because that's incredible that, you know, it's just at your fingertips, really.
Yeah, I believe it's like live, like even in that moment, access someone to be like, I'm having a bad trip. Well, hey, let's talk about this.
Incredible.
Yeah, let's have a conversation.
And then because I have to be the producer, and Adam is terrible at this part, for fans of the pod, we did recently launch our website. It's tappedintopsychedelics.com. You can see all the episodes. Show notes will be uploaded soon. There is also going to be a member section. So stay tuned for that. Check it out. Log in wherever you are as well. Like and subscribe the show. We rely heavily heavily on listeners like you out there, as well as our fantastic guests like Randall on the show. And if you'd like to throw a few schmeckles in our direction, we do have a donation button, so you can smash that and helps us continue to do what we're doing as part of this this project.
All donations will help fuel my Fabergé egg addiction. So don't think it's going for don't think it's going for anything relevant. Yeah. Well, anyways, Randall, again, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. I love what you're doing. I think you're a wonderful man, and you know, maybe I'll give you a hug in Denver. We'll see.
Are you going to be in Denver?
It's hard when you have a little kid. You know what I mean? And it's not her. I just miss that kid every time I go to work. So we'll see. I gotta sort some things out, and I should probably check and see if tickets are even still available, because those things sell out really rapidly. So I could just be full of shit right now. Who knows?
By the way, I'll tell you offline.
Mysterious.
There are still discounts on the conference.
Huh. Well, we'll continue this conversation. Well, anyways, Randall, absolute pleasure. We're going to include the links to everything, including your book, as well as the three charities. And it was great talking to you, and we'll talk soon.